Who Shot Goldilocks? Update January 2006. When we last visited the scene of the crime, the shooting of Goldilocks, the evidence showed that between the market high and low, $8.5 trillion in equity value had disappeared from Americans' pocketbooks. This is roughly four times the gross domestic product of China. 2.5 million Americans had lost their jobs, and the market had declined for 32 months, just 2 months short of the Great Depression. The effects of these losses was widespread and affected nearly every American. Alan Greenspan's reputation had suffered, and he labored mightily to repair it. Having admitted that we were in a soft spot, or a mild recession, he ate a bit of humble pie, but just a bit. In a speech to the American Economic Association in San Diego on January 3, 2004, 3 years after the emergency meeting of the Fed to cut interest rates when they realized they had driven the economy over a cliff, Greenspan took pains to defend the Fed policies, but he reflected uncertainty about how the system works and suggested that the Fed models were not very effective. He said, "Uncertainty characterized virtually every meeting, and the Fed Open Market Committee made decisions we came to regret." He remarked that forecasting was elevated to an even more prominent place in deliberations. You may recall that Townsend Greenspan, his firm before he became Fed chair, was dead last in the rankings by the Federal Reserve of firms forecasting the economy. Alan Greenspan's tenure as Fed chairman had benefited enormously from the high productivity surge that powered the 90s boom. He benefited by the advances in technology, which made the U.S. economy grow without noticeable inflation, and then he crushed the growth driver of the economy. During the 8 years of Clinton Greenspan, the economy produced 22.7 million jobs. But under Greenspan Bush, in 4 years, only 119,000 net new jobs were created, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics Payroll Survey. Real average hourly earnings rose at an annual average of 0.8% during the Greenspan-Clinton era, but under Greenspan-Bush, median household income dropped 2 years in a row, 2001 and 2002, the first time this had ever happened. The last drop was for 1 year, almost 50 years earlier. With a small recovery in 2003, incomes continued to drop in 2004. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the real income of the typical household in the United States has fallen over the last 5 years, in spite of the fact that 2002 through 2005 were years of economic expansion. The wealth gap between minorities and whites widened, according to the Pew Institute. So the question is, if Greenspan was a maestro, why was he so inconsistent? Why did he hit so many sour notes? By the time Goldilocks was published, Greenspan had already embarked on his new course of action, one meant to repair the damage the Fed had done in the 2000 to 2002 timeframe. You will recall that after the market crash, the Fed staff, with its 500 economists, reviewed the actions taken by the Japanese Central Bank after the Japanese market crash and concluded that the Japanese Central Bank had done too little and too late to solve Japanese economic problems. The Fed then seemingly adopted the Japanese playbook as Fed policy. After the crash, the Fed began a lethargic and intermittent reduction in interest rates. While the economy was gasping for oxygen, the Fed chose to ration help. It was not until after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, that the Fed became serious about stimulating the economy. They continued, with new vigor, their series of rate cuts that would last into June of 2003. But the Japanese experience showed that low interest rates alone do not a recovery make. Business confidence in the U.S. had been shattered. Consumer confidence had suffered, personal wealth had dissolved, reinvigorating the economy was a slow process. With confidence in the Fed and the overall economy still weak, S&P earnings declined into the second quarter of 2002, but then slowly began to recover. The equity markets hit its low for this cycle 6 months later on October 2, 2002. The recovery did not bring jobs with it, however, and came to be known as the jobless recovery. George W. Bush barely avoided becoming the first president since Herbert Hoover to see the number of jobs decline in his first 4 years in office. In fact, during the first 52 months of the Bush presidency, total employment was down 24,000 against an expected 10.9 million job growth. The Fed became concerned about deflation. Fed governors publicly spoke of buying up assets, including private assets, to prevent deflation. Implicitly, they were promising to print as much money and buy as many assets as needed to prevent deflation. These actions alone gave continued credence to the Greenspan put, the concept that when the markets ran into trouble, the Fed would bail them out. This concept gave rise to a moral hazard, for if true, the Greenspan put would introduce more volatility into the markets and induce riskier investments. Greenspan supported the Bush tax cuts because, he said, it would be too risky for the government to pay down its debt too quickly. The tax cuts led to record deficits. Later, in testimony before Congress in April of 2005, Greenspan warned Congress to scale back Social Security and Medicare benefits because the federal budget was on an unsustainable course. The Fed kept interest rates abnormally low for an extended period. As interest rates remained low, construction spending soared, especially spending on new homes. Since construction is, by definition, local, this had the effect of creating jobs in the U.S., which could not be outsourced. Greenspan counseled homeowners to take advantage of the new low interest rates and take out adjustable-rate mortgages, leading not only to borrowing for homes, but also for second mortgages to buy consumer products. Greenspan was literally putting the onus for the recovery on the backs of consumers. Consumers eagerly grabbed the cheap money and spent it, priming the pump for an economic recovery and leading to the lowest savings rate the U.S. had ever experienced. After the second quarter of 2002, S&P stocks saw profits rise, but the rise was not uniform and was largely driven by rising earnings in the energy sector. Many companies, particularly automobiles and airlines, saw huge losses. With interest rates low, the dollar weakened and our trade balances deteriorated. We essentially tried to outsource our economic problems. Employment went overseas to low-cost-of-production countries, particularly the emerging countries of Asia. Armed with large trade surpluses, foreign central banks such as China made massive purchases of U.S. bonds in order to keep the yuan from appreciating against the dollar and keeping their trade advantage. Because of economic growth in the emerging countries, inflation began to rise worldwide. This time, inflation wasn't the figment of Alan Greenspan's imagination. It was the real thing. Commodity prices worldwide jumped across the board, from copper to food and oil and everything in between. But Greenspan, who saw inflation under every rock in the ramp up to the 2000 crash, repeatedly denied the existence of inflation, repeating his mantra that inflation was under control. As every housewife knew, this was not the case. Manufacturers saw their prices rise as well, but for the most part were unable to pass the increases along to their purchasers. Greenspan once again ignored reality. It simply was not a convenient time to raise interest rates because the economy was still soft. Many people were still unemployed as job growth had not kept up with the need for new jobs, and George W. Bush was facing re-election. Alan Greenspan had set a record for visits to the White House during the Bush term, having visited on the average of once a week. The number of these visits was far more than with Clinton or the other presidents that Greenspan had served. One hoped that these conversations were about what was being done to get the economy moving, and maybe they were, but what they were certainly about was Greenspan's reappointment. Greenspan maintained that inflation was under control, even though it was obvious that it was not, right up to the announcement of his reappointment. In his message reappointing Greenspan, President Bush said that Alan Greenspan had done a superb job. This, of course, was the same statement that President Bush had made about Donald Rumsfeld after the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and about George Tenet, head of the CIA, shortly before Bush fired Tenet. Having secured his reappointment, Greenspan donned his old armor and again became an inflation fighter. Immediately upon his reappointment, Alan Greenspan discovered that there was inflation in the world and it had to be contained. He began a series of rate increases that have continued to this day and show signs of continuing further. Since he did not begin the rate hikes until June of 2004 and since the hikes would not have an effect for 6 to 9 months, he could feel confident that he had done all he could to promote the re-election of George W. Bush. The economy would not wilt under the interest rate hikes until after the election. Sure enough, in the second quarter of 2005, the economy softened. The Conference Board of Leading Economic Indicators dropped 5 months in a row by the end of May 2005. At the same time, Greenspan shrunk the money supply. Liquidity in the world sank to its lowest level since the crash of 2000. If this sounds familiar, it is because it is precisely this approach that led to the debacle of 2000-2002. Once again, Greenspan, having botched his job, provides a solution that creates yet more problems. His strategy now seems clear: slow the economy to control the inflation that his policies have helped to create, but which he maintained did not exist. Once again, the Fed was shocked out of its lethargic policies by an external event, this time in the form of a hurricane. Hurricane Katrina shocked America and the administration with a devastating blow to the Gulf Coast. Disrupting oil production and transport, oil prices soared. Property damage reached records, and hundreds of thousands of people were dislocated and jobless. The economy faltered, then rebounded, in part because of the rebuilding efforts directed at the hurricane losses. In the meeting after Katrina, the Fed voted to continue to raise interest rates, even though 5 of the 12 regional banks initially opposed a rate hike. Fed Governor Olson, the only businessman on the board, voted against the first hike. Today, worries abound regarding Fed policies. Will the Fed raise interest rates too high? What about the money supply? What happens to housing prices? Will there be another burst bubble? Will the construction industry suffer with high interest rates? What will happen to construction jobs? How will the lost jobs be replaced? Greenspan has provided a solution that created even more problems. Criticism of Greenspan, which began in 2000, has grown unabated as people have re-examined his term and his policies. It is fair to evaluate his 20-year term. Greenspan is to the Fed what J. Edgar Hoover was to the FBI, a longtime incumbent who accumulated enormous power that made him untouchable. The Fed evolved into groupthink, where the policies were set by Alan Greenspan and unquestioned. The cult of personality that evolved around Greenspan meant that even the White House was afraid to criticize him for fear of aggravating his Elvis in Vegas-like following. But as General George C. Scott once said, if everybody is thinking all alike, no one is thinking very much. Former members of the Fed say that Greenspan's style was autocratic. According to Alan Blinder, former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, the Greenspan standard has, for the most part, meant whatever Greenspan wanted to do. He was not a straight person, not open and direct. He has been criticized for keeping information from the other governors so that only he had the information. Governors were expected to vote with him unless they could not live with their votes, a much higher standard than disagreement, according to Lawrence Meyer, a Fed governor for 6 years. The result, according to Meyer, was that there were few dissenting votes. Because of the unwritten no dissent rule, Meyer says that during his term, while there was discussion at the FOMC meetings, at the conclusion of the discussion, Greenspan would pull the FOMC policy statement out of his pocket, where it had been all along, and the committee would vote in favor of it. Unlike previous Federal Reserve chairmen, Greenspan had addressed the markets and fiscal policy directly. He has spoken on nearly every aspect of the economy, becoming, as Alan Blinder said, the nation's unofficial economic wise man on just about any subject. Greenspan's willingness to tread into political controversies and offering opinions on matters far outside of his monetary policy has hurt the perceptions of the Federal Reserve as independent. His backing, and now criticism of the result, of the Bush tax cuts, Social Security reform, and trading his nomination for low interest rates shed all semblance of the political independence of the Fed. He became a partisan figure, and this may have led to the sharp decline in the Gallup poll number of Americans who said they have a great deal or a fair amount of confidence in him to do or recommend the right thing for the economy. Furthermore, if Greenspan is going to meddle in the affairs of Congress and the executive branch, it invites them to meddle in the Fed. as Congressman Emanuel, Democrat from Illinois, recently told the Washington Post regarding Greenspan, "There's a moat around the Fed that says he doesn't get involved in political discussions. He took the moat down." Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid labeled Greenspan a political hack. Stephen Roach, chief economist at Morgan Stanley in the January 2005 issue of Foreign Policy, opined that Greenspan had driven the world to an economic brink and that the difficulty would not be in replacing him, but cleaning up his mess. Also in January of 2005, John Macon, chief economist of the American Enterprise Institute, criticized Greenspan for creating a second bubble. Greenspan himself seems to now acknowledge that a housing bubble may exist and that the property boom is in imbalance and that home prices could fall. He said that in the future, the Fed would have to pay more attention to asset prices. Any analysis of the Greenspan legacy is premature until after this imbalance has been addressed by Greenspan's successor. The bursting of the housing bubble will have greater effects than the stock market bubble because people borrowed to buy their homes and leveraged them even more because of the encouragement of the Fed. A collapse will have greater effect on consumer spending and create more financial instability. As the headline in the New York Times said on November 20, 2005, "As the McMansions go, so goes job growth." Has Greenspan created a housing bubble to replace the jobs lost in the market collapse? But what can replace the housing bubble? In remarks to the American Bankers Association, September 26, 2005, Greenspan admitted that the housing market has the characteristics of a bubble, but only in certain markets, he said. Home prices have risen to unsustainable levels, he says, but adds that homeowners can absorb a house price drop. He further cautioned against adjustable-rate mortgages, the very mortgages that he formerly had advised homeowners to obtain. Greenspan argues that his mop-up strategy of dealing with excess is best, but if that is so, why did he crush the Goldilocks economy with rate hikes and monetary tightening? After the crash, it was necessary to create liquidity and keep interest rates abnormally low for an extended time, not only setting the stage for another asset bubble, but also creating the impression that the Fed will pump in liquidity after every crisis. The result is that investors are encouraged to take even bigger risks. Nicknamed Bubble Man by the New York Times, articles and editorials critical of Greenspan have appeared in national publications. On June 12, 2005, the New York Times, in an editorial titled "Mr. Bubble," criticized Greenspan's "What me worry" behavior and said, "Meanwhile, it is hard to take Mr. Greenspan's reassuring talk about the economy seriously when there's so much evidence to the contrary." By encouraging the American consumer to take on more debt, Greenspan has contributed to the run-up of U.S. foreign debt, something Paul Volcker decried in an article to the Washington Post, April 10, 2005. Other books critical of Greenspan have followed "Who Shot Goldilocks?" and "One Can Expect More" when Greenspan is out of office. But Greenspan has not been without honors. In a ceremony on November 13, 2001, Greenspan accepted the Enron Award for Distinguished Public Service. Just a few days after the energy company admitted that it had filed 5 years of misleading financial reports, Greenspan told the audience, "The best chance you have of making a big success in this world is to decide from square one that you're going to do it ethically." On November 9, 2005, Alan Greenspan was awarded the Medal of Freedom Award, the nation's highest civil honor. He was given the award for his outstanding public service and for enhancing the prosperity of our nation. On this date, he was joined in receiving this award by others such as Jack Nicklaus, Andy Griffith, Carol Burnett, and Muhammad Ali. And on December 2, 2005, the group of seven finance ministers meeting in London awarded him a traditional British dispatch case. But on the day of the announcement of Greenspan's successor, the Dow rallied 170 points, and the S&P was up almost 1.7%. The road ahead, under construction. Now, in the winter of 2005, the yield curve has nearly flattened. In the past 3 decades, the Federal Reserve has tightened 8 times. In 5 of those 8 times, the yield curve has inverted. In every one of the 5 cases, the economy has experienced a recession 1 year later. Are we again on the brink of an inverted yield curve and a recession? uncertainty abounds. Profits, mostly oil profits, have been rising, and GDP now stands at 4+%. Productivity continues to increase, but those are historical numbers. If one focuses on the future, it is hard to get past the restrictive Fed policies and the rising cost of oil. The price of oil again approaches $60 a barrel. The Fed is both raising interest rates and shrinking the money supply. An investor must therefore be very cautious about the future. And what of the housing bubble? If indeed there is a bubble, the cost could be enormous. The U.S. budget deficit has been financed by dollars bought externally. Should the U.S. economy falter, an investor might anticipate that foreign investors would quickly tire of holding U.S. dollars. If that occurs, then we could see the dollar fall sharply and interest rates rise dramatically. And how is the new Fed chairman to deal with all of this? On the positive side, Ben Bernanke, the new chair of the Federal Reserve, has pledged to be a better communicator. This will be a welcome relief from the constructive ambiguity of Greenspan. It might actually do away with the them and us mentality and help businesses and individuals plan for the future. It may also facilitate decision-making inside the temple. Perhaps if Fed governors had equal access to information and the ability to express themselves in a meaningful way, decisions might be reached in an institutional manner, not just the whim of one man. Whether they will be better decisions, we can only guess, but I am betting on a collective and collaborative intelligence decision-making process against that of the Lone Ranger. Goldilocks set forth numerous suggestions for reform of the Federal Reserve System. I believe they are still valid and hope they will be addressed under the new chairman. Will Rogers once said, "Good judgment comes from experience, and a lot of that comes from bad judgment." We have had our share of bad judgment. Let us profit from our experience.